Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, the emotional cost of the pandemic has been great, but there's also been a financial cost, with hospital stays and follow-up care for many, what it means for healthcare coverage going forward. We'll also hear how the pandemic has impacted language development for some children. And a doctor in an area of the state that is lagging in vaccination rates shares his concerns. Also, has hemp delivered on its promise to farmers?
Producers are really still determining the best way to grow hemp as a crop and if it's feasible really to include in their rotation.
We'll talk with some about what they need. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, the vaccine rollout has been successful in lowering COVID-19 numbers, but some parts of the state still have low vaccination rates. We'll hear from a doctor in one of those areas about his concerns. Hemp was touted as a new cash crop for many farmers, but has it lived up to the hype? And we'll preview a unique fishing tournament in Illinois. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. When Illinois lawmakers approved recreational marijuana in 2019, they promised a chunk of the new tax revenue would go to communities unfairly targeted by the war on drugs. That money is now starting to flow in the form of grants, and it's supposed to help address long-standing issues in historically underserved parts of the state. Eric Schmid reports, Illinois is living up to its promise in some ways, but in others, it's still falling short.
25% of the tax revenue from cannabis sales goes to the state's Restore, Reinvest, and Renew grant program, known as R3. This year, that's about $32 million. State leaders say the program will bankroll projects in underserved communities that haven't had funding in the past. This prospect thrilled Dana Williams, the executive director of the Community Wellness Project in East St. Louis.
We were very excited to know that Illinois was actually going to use some of the tax revenue and put it back into the community so that we could develop programs and services to help reduce high-risk behaviors.
Williams applied for a little more than $200,000 to enhance her organization's sexual health services. She felt like she had a strong application, but Williams' proposal wasn't included in the grants announced in January.
The amount of money that we were requesting, it was literally less than the drop in the bucket. It would have really provided some real hands-on community work that is so needed in the area.
The grants are administered by the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority, and 80 organizations and governmental bodies across the state received the initial awards, including three projects focused in Metro East communities. Nearly 400 groups applied in the first round. After writing the application last year, Williams says the R3 grant program didn't feel accessible for most community-based organizations.
And so if you aren't an agency that's established, if you didn't already have grant writers, you were going to be very challenged.
DeWanda Crockerell, who directs the Joe Roberts Youth Club in Venice, says she didn't consider applying at first because she felt the program was too complex for her smaller organization to manage. Crockerell did write a grant application, but only after the City of Madison approached her to apply as a collective along with the Quad City Community Development Center. Still, she says the application's 20-page limit was daunting.
That alone was scary. Some of the details that they were looking for, an average not-for-profit with primarily volunteers, would not have been able to complete it.
A spokesperson for the authority says the agency prioritized accessibility for smaller-scale applicants by providing training and community engagement. They also say the authority will continue to review and update the application process for future rounds of funding. Crockerell helped the City of Madison successfully win a $92,000 grant to perform a risk assessment of the community. But she says she hasn't been able to get the project off the ground because the state spent months reviewing every part of the application's budget. Crockerell says the total grant, of which her organization would only see $30,000, isn't worth the amount of work from the state.
By making it so stringent, a lot of the smaller organizations such as ours are considering pulling out the process completely.
This isn't the case for all applicants, though. Henrietta Young directs the Griffin Center After School Program in East St. Louis, which has been able to broaden its curriculum because of R3.
We can hire the additional staff and get the equipment, computers, et cetera, that we would need.
Its partner organization, Catholic Urban Programs, was part of an $830,000 award to six East St. Louis-based organizations to expand out-of-school programming. The grant received final administrative approval in April. Young says the funds allow them to seriously consider opening another center in the city and hire someone to strengthen their relationship with the schools.
We have not had advocates in the school setting like we would have liked. So now we're looking for an educational advocate who will go into the schools, speak with the teachers, see why our kids are not doing well in certain subject areas.
Tony Muhammad is the executive director of Catholic Urban Programs and says R3 provides essential resources for the area, especially after the coronavirus exposed long-standing inequities.
The children in this community need this funding.
Beyond Catholic Urban Programs, Muhammad says the R3 grant demonstrates the collaborative power between her organization and others in the community and their ability to show leaders in Illinois what the area needs.
And they showed up and supported us with this funding. Especially in East St. Louis, it's better to work as the collective than as individual organizations to make the greatest impact for the children.
The money behind R3 will only grow as Illinois' recreational cannabis industry expands. And Muhammad says she expects the collaborative will look to renew for more funding in the future. I'm Eric Schmid.
Also related to cannabis, this week the governor announced three lotteries for upcoming retail licenses. Some of those are earmarked for people of color and communities hit hard by the war on drugs. Last summer, protests fueled a debate over police in schools, and in many cities, the conversation about what are referred to as school resource officers, or SROs, is not over. Peter Medlin took a look at Rockford's school safety data to examine police incidents with students there and how the pandemic affected them.
Since the 2014-15 school year, Rockford Public Schools referred students to law enforcement for school discipline matters 2,379 times. The number of police incidents climbed from around 300 a year up to 503 in 2018-19. Catherine Dunn with the Racial Justice Organization Advancement Project says that number doesn't paint the whole picture.
What we know, likely extremely underrepresentative of students' interactions with school police.
Schools are required to log incidents, but since officers are often on site or requested through school radios, not every interaction is filed. And RPS's student population is 31% Black, but nearly half of police incidents involved Black students. Police incidents in Rockford schools dropped significantly during COVID-19 as fewer students were in the buildings and interactions were limited. Dunn says that holds true with national data.
There were some districts that employed SROs in interesting ways during the pandemic, I think including doing like house checks during virtual learning. But I think overall, students' interactions with police definitely, declined.
Rockford Public Schools employs 10 SROs led by Sergeant Timothy Speltz. He says the pandemic had a major impact on what school resource officers could do.
We reduced the staffing from the 9 officers to the 6, so each officer had to cover multiple schools just because of the reduced amount of students in each school.
Spelt says they're in schools to build relationships with students so they feel comfortable coming to officers if there's a serious issue. That didn't really happen during COVID because they had limited access to students.
We take the approach, it's called the triad. We act as a mentor, a counselor / classroom presenter, and then the law enforcement arm. The majority of our interactions are as counseling.
Many calling for SROs to be removed say they aren't qualified to be counselors. Officers complete a week-long certification before starting, and Spelt says most training on how to be a mentor to kids happens on the job. Opponents say schools should hire more mental health support staff instead. They also say officers don't make buildings safer either. Research is inconclusive as to whether they can help prevent mass shootings, but SRO organizations point to specific examples, like at Dixon High School, where an officer was able to apprehend a student who opened fire in the building. One study also showed a link between more police and lower graduation rates. Unlike many districts, Spelt says his division has actually shrunk since he started.
When I came into the unit, we had 12, and then maybe 2 years later, they reduced it to 9 SROs.
Back in 1975, 1% of schools had officers. In 2018, around 58% had a police presence. The number of SROs has continued to increase over the past several years, and that's come with a rise in law enforcement referrals and student arrests, according to the most recent federal civil rights data collection. But there's been a slight decrease in exclusionary discipline like expulsion and suspensions.
Referrals actually increased, I think, as much as 12%. So a pretty significant jump, which indicates, I think, that as we are less inclined to use things like suspension and expulsion, we are doing things like referring students to law enforcement in place of that.
Out-of-school suspension numbers have fallen in Illinois, but schools like East High School in Rockford still rank in the top three statewide. In-school suspensions have risen, with Auburn High School having the second most in the state last year. Catherine Dunn says this year, the Biden administration doubled funding for the COPS police hiring program, which includes grants for school resource officer positions.
While the federal government doesn't make up the largest share of funding for school police, they are often kind of the seed that plants police in school districts, and then state and local governments are left to kind of pick up the bill.
The Counseling Not Criminalization Act was also recently introduced in Congress, which would end the federal government's financial support of school police. Whether or not it passes, the conversation around the role of school police and how they interact with students won't be going away anytime soon. I'm Peter Mudlin.
Mass testing and vaccinations, hospital stays, lost work, and lost opportunities. The COVID-19 pandemic has cost Americans a lot. And for most, the toll is immeasurable, as Dana Vollmer tells us.
People's experience with COVID varies widely. Some contract the virus and get little more than a fever, while others spend months in the hospital, or worse, don't make it at all. Dr. Rich Ganetti is Regional Director of Primary Care for OSF Healthcare in Bloomington. He says the strain on hospitals has also been mixed.
We've had them 3 to 4 days to 3 to 4 weeks. I mean, it's very variable. People, you know, end up on ventilator and ICU, they're in there for a long time. And some people are discharged on home oxygen.
Ganetti says treatment for COVID improved rapidly over the course of the pandemic, allowing more people to be treated at home, but many still require medical attention.
Over half of the people will see a doctor after they've had their infection, and maybe 20% of them may see a specialist. We have people go to rehab, they can see a cardiologist. We've got some plans on people that are suffering, but a lot of it's supportive at this time.
Ganetti says treatment plans are more complicated for people with long COVID. That's when symptoms last more than 4 weeks after infection. Early research by the CDC suggests this occurs in about 10% of people who contract the virus. Under normal circumstances, a lengthy hospital stay, ventilator use, and appointments with specialists could spell a hefty medical bill for patients. But COVID patients typically don't see a bill at all. Mike Allen is chief financial officer of OSF Healthcare. Allen says hospitals that accepted CARES Act dollars agreed to certain things, like covering the cost of testing and vaccines. He says insurance companies largely covered COVID treatment and hospital stays, with big companies like Blue Cross Blue Shield waiving copays and deductibles for coronavirus patients through most of the pandemic. Insurance companies began reinstating those fees earlier this year. Allen says the same is true for those on Medicare and Medicaid, and for those who are uninsured, they were covered by COVID relief dollars.
I'm sure there are exceptions that popped out, and you could have somebody with insurance that has a large deductible. That happens too. I think those are going to be relatively few and far between.
In those rare cases, he says, hospitals have financial assistance available to help people with out-of-pocket costs. That doesn't mean COVID care is free. Allen says there might not be an individual cost, but there is a societal cost.
Whether you get the bill or not, we have to pay the bill as taxpayers or health plan members. It's a shared cost across the country. We are collectively paying through it through our health insurance premiums, or we're paying collectively through it through the tax.
The CARES Act included more than $175 billion for hospitals and healthcare providers to care for COVID patients. Allen says those reimbursements have helped immensely, especially during outbreak peaks. He says there was a time last fall OSF was admitting more than 450 COVID patients a day, more than a quarter of all hospital beds. But Allen says federal and state grants haven't covered everything. He says OSF has taken a loss caring for COVID patients, although they have been able to adjust. Hospital bills aren't the only expense a COVID patient incurs, especially those with long-haul symptoms. 20-year-old Sarah Wielander of Leroy contracted COVID last fall. She suffered what doctors think was a mini-stroke. About 9 months later, she's still experiencing brain fog. She has a hard time focusing, her short-term memory is impaired, and her energy levels remain low. Sarah lost out on work and a year of college. She saw Mayo Clinic doctors after her initial diagnosis. She also met with an educational psychologist to craft a plan to return return to college. Insurance did not cover those things, and they cost the Wielanders thousands of dollars. Sarah's mother, Patty Wielander, says that's nothing compared to the emotional toll.
We're still at the point where I don't know what the final outcome will be. So if it's something that just delays her being able to achieve her goals for a few years, it's a lot different than if she is never going to be able to, I guess.
Sarah Wielander says the most frustrating part is not being able to do the things she could do before, like hang out with friends or audition for a play.
In my head, I'm like, oh, I want to do this, this, this. Like, this would be so much fun. But then I have to, like, step back and be like, well, like, can you realistically do that with the amount of, like, energy you have and, like, the amount of, like, brain power that you're able to exert before you have nothing left?
Before her COVID diagnosis, Sarah planned to move in with a friend and start an independent life as a college student. None of that can happen right now. She says her friends' lives are moving along faster and without her.
It's kind of frustrating because it's like, well, my friends are going to graduate before me, so they're going to, like, doing, like, adult jobs, moving on with their life faster than me.
Sarah says it's also frustrating to know she'll be trapped in minimum wage jobs for longer. She recently started a new job in retail. She says it took a while to find a position where her managers would understand the challenges she might face in remembering how to use a cash register or clock in for her shift. Those cognitive challenges can be disheartening. Dawn McBride is a psychology professor at Illinois State University.
Cognitive resources have a limit, and we all know this. We know that there's only so many things we can do at once. There's only so many tasks we can take on and try to remember. But as people start to make mistakes, as people start to forget things, it does tend to affect their self-image.
Depression and anxiety are common symptoms of long COVID. McBride says not being able to do the things you used to be able to is hard on people. McBride says it's also an adjustment for businesses, which have expectations for productivity that don't always take into account an individual's circumstances, especially if they're not operating at full capacity for months.
As people are sort of emerging from this, it's going to be a slow process to getting people back up to their level of productivity where they work. Some people may have, you know, decided, for example, that their own well-being is best served by, you know, slowing down a little bit.
Healthcare providers and long COVID patients agree the not knowing is the hardest part, when or whether symptoms will subside or when the pandemic will end. I'm Dana Vollmer.
You're listening to Statewide. There's more to come. We're back on Statewide, and still to come, has hemp turned out to be the boon for farmers that some predicted? That story and more is ahead. Less than 50% of West Central Illinois residents are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. Dr. Ed Card is the chief medical officer at McDonough District Hospital and says that should be a concern for everyone. Rich Egger reports.
He says the vaccine can prevent someone from getting a serious case of the virus or getting infected at all. And Card says there's more to it than that.
It's really about limiting replication of the virus, that we need to prevent it from being spread from person to person, because every time that happens, it's an opportunity for the virus to mutate. And as the virus mutates and evolves, it may become more and more aggressive. So this really isn't just about whether or not I get sick or you get sick. It's really about protecting us all from this virus's ability to mutate.
What would you say to encourage someone who is not vaccinated to get vaccinated?
First of all of the concerns about the safety of the vaccine, I think, are greatly overblown. I was asked a question about whether or not it would make someone magnetic. I mean, if things like that are out there, really we need to stop and critically think about whether or not that is a reason to not get a vaccine. It doesn't affect your DNA. The RNA viruses are incapable of going backwards into the genome. So that is not an issue. It has been shown time and time and time again that they do not interfere with reproduction. They do not decrease female fertility. All of these things have been looked at and have been shown not to be true.
So right now, this is the vaccines are being used under, I guess, emergency use authorization, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Would you say FDA approval would give people no excuses at that point to not get vaccinated?
I would think so, but people can be remarkably capable of coming up with excuses to not do things they don't want to do. We just really need to not let this be a political thing and to look at the public health side of it, and all of us sort of step up and take care of ourselves and our neighbors.
I'm curious, just quickly, do you know anyone personally who's had COVID, and how did and how bad of a case did they end up with?
Yes, I do know people who've had COVID. I have had multiple exposures prior to being vaccinated, and continue to see people with it on an ongoing basis. So it's real and it's here. Additionally, you know, the hospital recently on our Facebook page posted videos which specifically look at the concerns that people have about the vaccine and tries to debunk some of those myths. From, you know, various specialties who know their part of the story better than I do.
Dr. Ed Card is Chief Medical Officer of McDonough District Hospital. He says almost every person who dies now from COVID-19 was unvaccinated. McDonough County is not alone in having a fairly low vaccination rate. Every county in the West Central Illinois region has less than half its population fully vaccinated against COVID-19. Knox has the highest rate with more than 44%. Henderson has the lowest with 21%. Henderson is the only county in the region with a vaccination rate below 30%.
That's Rich Egger with that report. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention states that those who are fully vaccinated can forego wearing a mask, except when required by law or other regulations. The World Health Organization, meanwhile, recommends everyone wear a mask, regardless of their vaccination status. That's due to the Delta variant. Yvonne Booz talked to a Northern Illinois psychology professor who says some people are just perplexed.
John Jensen is fully vaccinated. He says continuing to wear a mask in certain settings is not about him.
But I think it's a courtesy that I can offer to the people around me. And so, yeah, I was sitting here without it when there were people at a distance, but I'm happy to put it on for other people in the world.
Brad Sagrin is a psychology professor at Northern Illinois University.
Part of the complexity right now is that when we're not sure what to do, one of the clues that we use is we look around to see what other people are doing. And at the moment, we look around and see some people with masks, some people without masks, and that gives us a pretty confusing mixed message.
Sagrin says deciding to wear or not to wear a mask isn't that simple. He notes that the actions of some people last year show that mask wearing can symbolize other things.
So it's not just a health decision. It's a statement of somebody's politics. It's a statement about somebody's perception of freedom, about health policy and that sort of thing. And that makes the decision of whether or not to wear masks very, very complicated.
Sagrin suggests that some people may also find it hard to take their mask off for another reason. They aren't sure if people around them who aren't wearing a mask have been vaccinated. Jensen admits that this is also something that bothers him.
I guess I'll confess to being slightly annoyed by the folks who probably aren't vaccinated, but because no one was going to check, they've taken their masks off already. So I do have a little bit of I'm probably a little cranky about that if I let myself be.
Wearing a mask wasn't the norm for most people prior to the pandemic. Sagrin says it may be something we continue to see after things settle down.
If people make the decision that they'd like to protect themselves by continuing to wear a mask, I do think that this last year has made that a lot more socially acceptable in this country.
Not only did masks help prevent the spread of the coronavirus, it contributed to the reduction of another respiratory disease. Data from the CDC states that influenza activity decreased. The weekly median from May until August last year was 0.2% compared to 2.35% in 2019. Sagrin says if someone is sick, that will be the most important time for them to cover their nose and mouth.
And you know what? I understand and respect that as a health decision that people can make for themselves.
He points out that mask confusion can also arise when people look to authorities to figure out what they should do.
And one of the things that I definitely recommend is that organizations and businesses have clear guidelines and communicate those guidelines for mask wearing, because that can remove a lot of the uncertainty and make it a lot easier for people to make decisions about whether or not to wear a mask.
Sagrin says despite confusion, individuals should continue to do what's comfortable for them and their family. I'm Yvonne Booz.
The pandemic has been stressful for many families, and that stress can affect a child's development, including language and social skills. To learn more, Christine Herman spoke with Northwestern University's Elizabeth Norton, who studies language development in children. Norton says young kids learn to speak by interacting with caregivers and explains how the pandemic has disrupted that process for many.
So one thing that could differ in the pandemic is that parents may not be as available to have those high quality back and forth interactions with their kiddos. So that's one of the things that we're really keeping an eye on in terms of how kids are starting to hit those language milestones, like babbling first words, combining words through toddlerhood. And then as kids get older, they are really starting to learn language not only from their caregivers, but also from their peers. So the lack of peer interaction that would kind of help kids perhaps learn new words in toddlerhood and learn about new concepts and things like that, some kids may be missing out on. So we're thinking about that a lot. And we're also, there are certain groups of kids that we're kind of keeping a closer eye on that we're a little bit more concerned about. For example, we know kids who have hearing loss or deafness and kids who are bilingual but typically developing are more likely to look at the mouth of the person they're talking with to kind of get a little bit of extra information. And so as we're all wearing masks, we are really curious about how especially those kids who are more likely to pay attention to people's mouths are able to understand speech and if they are going to have any changes in their language development because they're interacting more often with people who are wearing masks.
It is interesting to think about how, I mean, lots of health experts in various arenas have said, you know, obviously this pandemic has kind of shown a spotlight on existing disparities and existing inequities when it comes to healthcare.
Absolutely.
But also education and how all these factors influence child development. And it can be a little disheartening to think about how the disparities could be exacerbated as a result of this pandemic. Some parents of young children might be concerned about the longer term or lasting impacts this pandemic year may have had on their child's development, especially around their social and language skills in particular, because of the social isolation that many kids have experienced. Is that a cause for concern? Are kids generally able to bounce back from these kinds of setbacks and be just fine down the road?
I would say that generally, kids are quite plastic and their brains are very flexible. They can adapt to lots of different environments. So some kids grow up in cultures where the norm is to not really speak to kids very much when they're very young. Other kids grow up in environments, for example, where mom is wearing a face covering all the time and they don't ever see their mom's mouth or very rarely see their mom's mouth move and things like that. So in general, the brain is quite plastic. Kids are quite adaptable and flexible. So in a lot of ways, I'm optimistic that we won't have, you know, a generation of children who are, you know, substantially different in their ability to use language and engage in social situations and things like that. I think we will have kind of an opportunity to learn a lot about how these kinds of factors shape things. We have this opportunity, unfortunately, all these terrible effects of the pandemic, but it gives us this really unique window to understand what kind of experiences do make a big difference and for whom, you know, whether there are certain things that are going to affect some kids really, you know, meaningfully, whereas other kids will be relatively okay. In general, I would say I'm sort of an optimist and I believe in the flexibility of the brain to adapt. And so I would guess that by and large, kids are going to be okay.
That's Elizabeth Norton. She's an assistant professor in communication sciences at Northwestern University, and she spoke with Christine Herman. Would-be scammers have ramped up text message campaigns to Illinoisans, pretending to be a handful of state agencies. Maybe you've received one. The texts are purportedly from the Illinois Department of Transportation, Employment Security, and Secretary of State. They contain links to websites that are designed to get users' personal information. The state attorney general is investigating the scams, and Governor J.B. Pritzker has warned Illinoisans to not click on those links.
So you should be extra careful when you receive those, and especially when you receive something out of the blue that just looks like, why am I receiving this?
State agencies generally contact Illinoisans by mail or occasionally a phone call or email if someone has an open case. Even so, the state agencies that scammers are posing as have been receiving hundreds of complaints about the text messages, including from those who fell for the scam. Well, just a few years ago, hemp was seen as a growth opportunity for farmers, but it's proven risky. And for Harvest Public Media, Brian Grimmett explains why it's been more difficult than expected and how some would like a little more help from the government.
In an industrial building near the airport in Pratt in south central Kansas, workers break open a 1,200-pound bag of industrial hemp stalks, grains, and flowers and dump it onto a large conveyor belt. The facility, operated by Shining Star Hemp Company, is one of only 11 licensed hemp processors in the state. Jennifer Holmes works with Shining Star to develop and market products.
This is an auger that leads to our hopper. This is where we dump the flower biomass. It's taken up, dumped in there, evenly distributed to our shaking table. The shaking table has interchangeable plates, and you can separate different types of material.
After explaining as much as she could, she waved down a man driving a forklift.
Paul here on the forklift, he's the mastermind behind all of that. He's really put all of this together.
It's about probably 30 years of beating your head against the wall mostly.
Paul McGeary is a contractor for Shining Star and developed its processing machinery. He applied what he learned over decades of sifting wheat and corn to develop this machine to sift hemp. He says the complexity of the process is part of what's holding the industry back. It just doesn't have the scale to supply manufacturers who would put the fiber to use.
We were walking in there, people walk into those meetings thinking they're, you know, having 30, 40,000 pounds on hand is something. But when you walk into industry and they want, you know, 5 train cars a day or 10, you know, a train load a week or whatever, we just aren't prepared for that. And getting them to wait until we're prepared, that's the bottleneck of the whole thing.
Hemp has been hyped as something with a wide range of industrial uses. Make paper from the stalk or biodegradable plastics, food from the seeds, oils from the flowers. But so far, the only market the industry is pushing seems to be for its cannabinoid or CBD-rich oil. And there's a flood of CBD already on the market.
We don't have the best of luck selling full-spectrum oil. That's because CBD is a saturated market. It's just something that we all need to work through and do the right thing moving into grain and the fiber industry.
But that will take millions in investments in new equipment. And until that equipment can be designed, built, or purchased, companies interested in making products from hemp fibers are out of luck. A company in Newton, Kansas, wants to make prosthetic limbs from hemp. It imports its processed hemp from overseas. Holmes wants more government help to offset some of the risk for investing in converting the plant into something useful for industry.
A lot of people are scared to start because they don't know if they're going to fail, so they don't ever get started. And then if they have incentives or grants or help or support, we could all work together, and I believe we could really make the industry thrive.
But it's not yet. The Kansas Department of Agriculture says its hemp growing licenses dropped from 218 in 2020 to only 81 this year. And last year, of the almost 4,000 acres planted, only 761 were harvested for production. And an eighth of that had to be burned by the state because it contained too much of the psychoactive chemical THC. Braden Hoke is the state supervisor of the industrial hemp program.
Past 2 years have, I guess, really helped individuals get up to speed with vetted industry production standards, those becoming more apparent. But producers are really still determining the best way to grow hemp as a crop and if it's feasible really to include in their rotation.
He says growers and processors need to expand beyond CBD products. But with federal and state rules surrounding the crop in constant flux, finding the right investors that can spur that kind of innovation and development will remain challenging. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Brian Grimmett.
Well, stay with us. Statewide continues in just a moment. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still to come, what do you do when an invasive fish has taken over? You hold a fishing tournament. And how the fish are caught is what makes it interesting. We'll hear more. That's ahead. The pandemic has affected the mental health of many, and that includes children deeply impacted by restrictions on their schooling and recreation, as well as stress the parents are feeling. The state of Iowa established a children's mental health system 2 years ago, but some are worried the services are falling short, just as kids need more of them. For Side Effects Public Media, Natalie Krebs brings us the story.
Jeanette Lems says the trouble for her kids really began when they started school last fall. Her 7-year-old daughter struggled with being limited to just interacting with several kids who didn't include her friends. And her 5-year-old son was displaying a lot of anger and aggression.
We could not figure out what the meltdowns were and what the cause was, and took us a really long time to get his feelings sorted out.
Lem says her daughter got help from a counselor at her school in suburban Des Moines, but finding help for her son was much harder. She tried online therapy sessions, but he couldn't stay focused, so she sought out in-person play therapy instead.
I called 8 different places. I was told that they had no openings until May. And this was in January.
Lems was finally able to find an independent therapist near her home. The sessions have greatly helped her son, but the experience was eye-opening.
I had no idea that there were so many troubled children, you know, at the age of 5, 6, that were having to seek out mental health.
Long-term data on kids' mental health during the pandemic is still scarce, but some early figures suggest it's taking a toll. Mental health-related emergency room visits are up a lot. They increased 24% for young children and 31% for teens from March to October of last year compared to 2019.
There seems to be just a lot more stress, sadness, anxiety, and loneliness these days, but it's not everyone.
Laura Fuller is a clinical psychologist at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. She says the pandemic has clearly exposed the state's dire need for more mental health resources. Her system's waiting list has stretched weeks, even months at times, for children and families.
When you think about the more rural regions of the state, the places that aren't close to big cities and higher concentrations of providers, it's even worse.
Part of the problem is due to the unusual way Iowa has funded mental health services, by relying on local property taxes. It's a system left over from the early 20th century when people with mental illnesses lived in county homes.
That's how they became responsible for people who essentially couldn't take care of themselves.
That's Peggy Halbert, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness Iowa. She says Iowa is the last state in the nation to fund mental health through property taxes. As a result, funding has greatly differed across the state's 14 mental health and disability services regions. And even though the state has set certain standards for children's mental health, Halbert says it hasn't held the regions accountable.
It shouldn't matter where you live in Iowa. You should have access to the same services. That's not happening.
Now Iowa is moving to end that patchwork system. The state legislature voted recently to shift funding from the regions to the state. Still, some Iowa families say more help is desperately needed for kids, like Des Moines resident Nina Rickman. Her 2 adopted sons have anxiety and behavioral issues from childhood trauma. Rickman says the pandemic was so hard on her kids, their therapist recommended they go into residential treatment programs. She searched for months to find spots for them. Meanwhile, she struggled with the stress and uncertainty and plunged into depression herself.
There never was any timelines and there never was any certainty. So it was just hard to know. And so if you have a little bit of hope, sometimes you can make it a little bit longer, even if you're in a really stressful situation. But I think my hope just kind of ran out.
Rickman was eventually able to get spots for them in facilities hours away. She says they're doing much better, and so is she. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Natalie Krebs.
Well, Governor J.B. Pritzker has signed a law that makes Illinois the first state in the nation to require schools teach about Asian American history. Hannah Meisel has the details.
Beginning in the 2022-2023 academic year, public elementary and high schools in Illinois must weave Asian American history into their curriculums. State Representative Jennifer Gahn-Gershowitz sponsored the legislation because it wasn't until law school that she learned about the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 or Japanese internment camps during the Second World War.
I had no idea that these laws existed, much less how deeply they had impacted my own family.
Later in life, the Glenview Democrat discovered how her Chinese immigrant grandparents fought deportation for more than a decade. The new Asian American History Curriculum Directive is the third in recent legislation mandating expanded Black history and LGBT history in Illinois schools. I'm Hannah Meisel.
It's the summer and schools are searching for silver linings from their COVID school year. Peter Medlin takes a look at one pandemic idea that has lasted, a food program that goes through the summer instead of ending when kids leave the building.
Boxes of fresh produce line cafeteria tables inside an elementary school in Amboy, Illinois. Tony Fasig just finished setting up for the summer food program, and families are starting to trickle in.
Good morning. Good morning. Half a watermelon per family. Do you want Bosco sticks, meal kits, or the sweet and sour chicken?
Okay.
So far, they've been giving out food to 100 kids a week, and the program is growing in the rural school district of around 700 students. Fasig says she thinks a lot of families may not know about the program yet, and others might pass on the groceries because they think other people are in greater need than them.
I've had some mothers go, oh no, we're fine, we haven't lost our jobs, you know, and I'm like, but come in and get a bag of groceries. I mean, it's all fresh produce, and right. This is all taxpayer funded.
Lisa Moore is a teacher at Amboy who has two kids of her own. She's picking out fresh strawberries and cucumbers. This is the first time that she's been at the free food mart and says her family has struggled a bit more financially because of the pandemic.
It's just kind of was overwhelming when I walked in and how much you can take per child. I'm okay. My husband's job was cut, so he gets like half what he used to. So there's challenges there where you have to pay for a college student.
The number of Americans relying on local food banks increased during the pandemic, and 4 in 10 people using them were doing so for the first time. COVID-19 forced the USDA to expand waivers for the National School Lunch Program last year, which has allowed schools to provide food to more families. Joshua Nichols is the superintendent at Amboy, and he says they saw a real need in their community for a summer food initiative.
There are very few districts that did that, and so it's like, is that okay that we've never done that? Or it kind of bothers me a little bit, you know, I mean, because we have the means to do it, and we haven't done it.
Every child is entitled to a full week's worth of food they can pick up every Wednesday around lunchtime. There are no financial qualifications. Kids don't even need to be there when families pick up the food. Lots of parents are working midday on a Wednesday, so they swing by on their lunch or have a babysitting grandparent stop by. Steve is one of those grandparents picking up food with his grandson, Mason. Their family has 7 kids between 2 and 12 years old, and Steve says the school's program has been a big help.
It'd be pretty costly to feed 7 kids, you know.
Tony Fasig and the other staff have also been able to deliver food to a few families without transportation. She's the head of the district's kitchens, and she spends time every week curating the produce options.
We just started getting cucumbers, zucchinis, and strawberries offered to us.
Baby carrots are a fan favorite, and she says they have to make sure that they're offering a healthy selection that kids will want to eat.
It's not nutrition until they get it in their tummies.
Food isn't just going out, it's also coming in from the community. Fasig takes a carton of eggs from one of the middle school custodians.
She raises chickens and she's always trying to pawn me eggs off, and last week she warned me.
The custodian trades the eggs for a few bags of groceries and a carton of milk.
Can you take a couple of packages of strawberries?
How do you get the strawberries?
You take a couple. You got more than one child. Take a couple of them.
Oh, thank you, Tony.
Yeah.
Federal food waivers are continuing through the 2021-22 school year, and that means Amboy and other school districts across the country will be able to offer a similar free lunch program next year, albeit with a few minor restrictions. And as long as the funding is there, school administrators hope they can keep fighting food insecurities as families recover from the financial effects of the pandemic. I'm Peter Medlin.
Kewanee residents are now enjoying a work of art that honors a hometown hero painted by a prisoner at the Illinois Department of Corrections Life Skills Reentry Center. The city, park board, corrections officials, and others unveiled a 12-by-16-foot mural of Mr. Baseball, Lewis Reynolds, a black pro player in the late 1890s and early 1900s. The warden says the mural is part of a social justice initiative at the center, and one of the goals was to give inmates a voice during the pandemic and after George Floyd's death. Because of COVID-19 restrictions, the artist and inmate, Nick Worley, designed and painted the mural by himself. He spent more than 500 hours on the project. You can see the Mr. Baseball mural at Kewanee's Northeast Park. That's along Highway 78, also known as Main Street. Well, after flooding and the COVID-19 pandemic forced back-to-back cancellations the past 2 years, the annual Redneck Fishing Tournament is back on for 2021. Tim Shelley talked with Betty DeFord, an organizer of the tournament, about it.
Each summer, thousands descend on the Mason County town of Bath, population 300, to hunt for the invasive Asian carp on the Illinois River. But for the last 2 years, that hasn't happened.
There have been so many people calling me the last 2 years, when are we going to have this again? When are we going to have this again? And, you know, I've actually missed it. I have met so many wonderful people from all over every state imaginable and all over the world, really, from this, and we all meet every year. And I made so many good friends, I missed them all. Plus the fun of catching those carp. It is a ball. It's hilarious to watch them. It really is.
The COVID-19 pandemic forced the cancellation last year. The year before, river flooding made the tournament unsafe to hold. Unlike many fishing tournaments, you don't need to bring your fishing rod.
You are allowed one handheld dip net per participant. It doesn't matter how big your boat is. There are no boat rentals here, so try to get a friend with a boat and bring it down here. You sign up 2 hours prior to each heat. We fish four of those. We fish two on Friday from noon to two and from four to six. Sign up 2 hours prior to. I would advise you strongly that if you want to get in this event, because we've got a lot of interest this year since we hadn't had it for 2 years. There is a boat ramp in Havana you can put in there, which is 8 miles away, or you can put in here in Bath. But make sure you're here early, get your boats in before you register.
Catching the fish comes with its own unique challenges.
They are totally crazy fish. You never know which way they're going. I guess one of their friends jumps up and the other friend tries to protect them or something, because when you're looking at one, the other one will get you. We've had people with black eyes and a broke nose and I don't know what all in this event. So that is why we let you dress in costume for each heat. And there is also a special prize for costumes if you're out in the boat fishing in this event. And you may wear protective gear also, because once you're out there, these carp are vicious little critters. They don't want to be caught, but they don't want you stirring up their water either. So they're jumping and going like crazy.
The invasive Asian carp were first brought to the U.S. in the 1970s. Their numbers have exploded since then, to the detriment of native species.
That is the reason we started this event years ago. It's to bring the awareness of these invasive silver Asian carp. They're the ones that jump out of the water. There's the ones that tear up the ecosystem. There's three other species also besides the silver. The silver ones, if you're out there trying to enjoy your water sports, which what else do we have around this small area? They've been attacking people on jet skis, jumping in boats. You don't dare take your little ones out in a John boat like we used to do, you know, fishing and stuff, because they're terrible. They're dangerous. If they'd hit a little kid, they could almost probably kill them. They hit them just right, and that's why we started this event, to bring the awareness to the people. If you don't have them in your waters, keep them out of your waters, because you'll never get rid of them.
Efforts are ongoing to prevent the fish from heading upstream into the Great Lakes. But for Bath, Betty DeFord says the tournament is the local community's way to make the best of the situation.
This thing has just taken off like crazy, and you know, the whole town gets in on the act. I also, down at the riverfront is where our activities were, and in 2013, I also enlisted helping our Central Illinois homeless veterans. And so we have raffle donations. purchase your raffle tickets and put in whatever container that you want, would like to win, that all goes 100% to our Central Illinois homeless veterans.
The tournament is scheduled for August 6th and 7th. I'm Tim Shelley.
Well, that's all the time we have for Statewide this week, but we'll be back next time when we'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this episode or past shows, you can find them at statewideshow.com, and our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.